Bill Fong, Professor of Philosophy at Easton State University. My guest today is David Archer from the Department of Philosophy at the University of St. Andrews in Scotland. I know that you're concerned about the nature and extent of privacy, especially the privacy of public figures. I want to talk about that today. Would it be helpful for the listener, though, if you would give us a definition of what you mean by privacy and perhaps some examples to illustrate?
Sure. I think what privacy means for my purposes, and that's within the context of the concern there might be about the right to privacy that public figures might have, what I mean is keeping non-public or undisclosed out of the public sphere personal information, where what I understand by personal information is that set of undocumented facts about a person that they themselves would wish to keep out of the public domain.
Okay. Could you give some examples?
Yeah, sure. I mean, I think that the most notable examples, maybe this is a British obsession, are facts about a person's sexual orientation or private sexual behavior. These are the sorts of facts about themselves that they, for their part, would wish not to see publicly disclosed.
Okay. Now, you say that people don't want this information disclosed. Certainly, what people want disclosed about themselves may vary considerably. There are individuals who might not want anything about their sexual life revealed in public. Mm-hmm. There may be some who wouldn't mind if a little bit was revealed, but not a whole lot. And there may be some that want the public to know about their sexual lives. Now, suppose I happen to be the latter sort of person. Suppose I'm the sort of person who doesn't mind if telling other people information about my private sexual life. But you, let's say, a reporter, and you disclose information that I have not, in fact, chosen to disclose myself. But it's the sort of information which, given the other things I said about myself, might not seem to be the kind of information that I wouldn't mind disclosed. Mm-hmm. Have you violated my privacy?
Well, I think that is the sort of difficult question that would have to be dealt with when you were devising the terms of regulating, let's say, the conduct of the press. It's clear, as you say, that there's a great deal of variance both between cultures and then within cultures between individuals about the kind of personal information that people would wish to see undisclosed. And any set of regulations is going to find it hard to be sensitive to all those degrees of sensitivity. I suspect regulations are going to have to say something like private sexual conduct or private sexual orientation. And then, of course, the right protects even those persons who really, as a matter of fact, are indifferent to its disclosure or non-disclosure. Any right can be chosen, we can choose whether to exercise the right or not. So it might be the case that, indeed, you violated my right to privacy, but I choose not to exercise what I also have a right to, is enforce the protection of that right.
Okay. Now, perhaps to proceed this about personal quirks, about what you might or might not like revealed. It's true that when people think about it, they often think about sexual matters. But suppose I happen to be a very religious person, but a very privately religious person. I feel as if, let's say, that my religion is just none of your business or none of anyone else's business. I mean, let's even suppose that I don't let the public know where I go to church. Would publishing information about where I attend a church be a violation of privacy on your view?
Oh, but I mean, there are nice, you know, more straightforward cases. There are those who are exceptionally sensitive about the disclosure of their age, and they might want to argue that this is the sort of item about themselves that is properly kept private. I think what one would tend to say here is that there are levels of presumption. After all, the right to privacy is not an absolute one. It's one that we can assume, we think, that it can be trumped by considerations of public interest. So, as it were, the weaker the case there is for keeping something private, the more likely it is that we can show a good case in terms of the public interest for disclosing these sets of facts. So, if, for instance, there was very good reason to make public your religious preferences or your private religious practices, I'm inclined to think the presumption that should be kept private becomes less weighty.
Well, so that suggests to me that, on your view, part of what's an issue here, well, actually, let me back up a second, because I think this is relevant to it, that when you're talking about the right to privacy, you're primarily concerned about public rules or perhaps even laws concerning what people can and can't reveal about you. At least explicitly, you're not concerned about what I might do as a sensitive individual, what I might reveal or might not reveal to someone else. Is that true?
Oh, sure. That's okay. The main context. Okay. Yes, of course. Right. Of course.
Actually, I want to come back and talk about that some more in a minute too. But that would suggest then that if you're going to have laws, which
or regulations,
regulations of some sort that limit what you can reveal about someone else, then they're going to have to be publicly agreed upon areas of a person's life that aren't going to be made public without their consent. And therefore, if I happen to be an individual who, in a particular society, doesn't want you to know about my religion, but everyone else is very open about their religion, then in a way, I'm just disadvantaged.
It could be, though all regulations can have some such provision as, and any matter about which an individual has good reason to feel due sensitivity. And this would allow us to take account of the person who does indeed, for reasons that we can show, are good ones, think that this is something they don't wish to see disclosed. There are, of course, going to be core matters that we could all agree upon as a society, the sorts of things that no one should have made private without, made public without their consent. But I think we ought to remain sensitive to the fact that there are different degrees of sensitivity about some matters between individuals, and a regulation that was insensitive to that matter, I think to that extent be a weaker regulation.
Okay. Now, let me go back a bit and talk about the sort of the non-political dimensions of this. I mean, the sort of case I'm talking about is not a case in which we ought to have any kind of laws or rules. But I'm wondering if it might not help us get a little bit clearer about what the notion of privacy is. I think I mentioned this case to you before. Some months ago, my wife and I were sitting in a pub in Scotland. And we were having a conversation. It was not an especially private conversation. In fact, we were talking about philosophy, the sort of thing that I might talk about with my students. So there was no private content in the sense that there was no detailed information about me at all, let alone detailed information that I didn't want others to know. Some fella just came up and plopped down in a chair adjoining our table about, I would guess, less than a foot and a half from our table, and clearly turned his head so we could listen to the conversation. Now, again, the content of the information was not, of what was going on in the conversation, was not private in your sense. But I would say I felt as if, in some sense, my privacy had been violated. Is that just a mistaken view on my part?
No, I think intuitions are going to differ here as to what we want to see included within the concept of privacy. The way in which you describe the example is interesting because some people, let's accept that some wrong is done to you here, or we feel that something bad is going on in the behavior of the third party. One thing we might want to say about this third party is that they are intruding upon your personal space, and that they would be doing you a wrong even if you weren't engaging in a conversation, even if you were just, say, sitting watching something happening elsewhere in the room. And would you want to see that included in the notion of privacy? That is just simply the control over a physical space that surrounds you. But your description of it suggested that the wrongfulness of it that makes appeal to the notion of privacy is the being able to overhear the conversation. That's what mattered. And that the same kind of wrong would be done if, in fact, they were physically removed from you, but were, say, holding a boom mic over you or had some listening device whereby they could hear every word you were saying. It might be that you could cover this kind of example by saying what matters in privacy is retaining control over the information that is personal, even though this is a case where the threat is not to lose any actual item of personal information. Their presence makes it impossible for you to retain control over the sorts of things that you would wish to keep public. They've left you no space in which you can keep a conversation private, though as a matter of fact, what you were talking about was not something you'd wish to see kept private anyway. Now, that's the sort of way one might start to deal with that kind of example.
Well, and it seems to me that's at least part of what would bother people in that sort of case. But I'm also wondering if there's something else that might bother people, that just the mere presence of someone, the mere intrusive presence, in this case, of someone, somehow alters the kind of interaction and relationship you're having. I mean, again, even though we were talking about the very sorts of things that you and I might be talking about now, we might be talking about in the air, having someone else sitting there with their face in the middle of the conversation changes it in a way.
Yes, yes. And I can imagine that, for instance, if there happened to be a sheet of glass between you and this person, but nevertheless that you were up against the glass on one side and they were pressing their nose and face against the other side of the glass, you might feel in some way that you'd lost some control over your space, so the glass made it impossible for them to hear what you were saying. Now, it might be we want to include this in the concept of privacy, and that the way we would do that is by appealing to the notions of bodily integrity or personal integrity, and suggest that violations of personal integrity incur not only when somebody, as it were, touches me or damages me, but when they intrude so far into my space that I have a certain loss of control over my bodily person. It might be that we'd want to include that in the notion of privacy. My own feeling is that it's best to retain, as it were, a core understanding of privacy in terms of the disclosure or non-disclosure of personal information, and that if we still think there's some wrong done in this intrusion into bodily space, there are other laws of trespass that we might invoke, or of harassment, which we could use to cover these kinds of wrongs.
Well, I mean, to play the devil's advocate here, though, I'm against the position I just argued, I can imagine someone saying, "Look, Lafala, you're just being silly about this."
Mm.
You are having a conversation. The fact that the person's there listening to it does not, or at least should not, alter the conversation in any way.
Sure.
And all this talk about privacy is just a way of masking the fact that you're uncomfortable having someone through there. Get over being uncomfortable and just going on with your conversation.
Oh, there's a familiar argument that I've seen one philosopher refer to as the countercultural argument, that in a culture which was freed from these rather restrained middle-class puritanical inhibitions about personal space and personal integrity, we would find no embarrassment or cause to complain if people behaved in this kind of way to us, and that this would also be the case whether the activities we're engaged in and overlooked were ones we normally think now, ones we should feel deeply embarrassed about. The reply is simply that, as it happens within our culture, there is a shared understanding that certain kinds of behavior are unacceptable, and I think you're rightly appealing to the intuition that here's an instance of the sort of behavior most of us would not only feel uncomfortable in the face of, but feel we had legitimate cause to complain about.
Well, let me ask you this. I mean, you're talking about the sort of cultural norms. Might you be willing to embrace the following position, that what matters for privacy is not any specific list of behaviors or information that has to be kept private across cultures, but that what seems to be true of most cultures is that they want some things kept private, though what they want kept private may vary from culture to culture?
I think that's true, and this is always the problem of regulations too rigid, and we will in fact not allow for the kind of sensitivities that we can acknowledge are real ones, too flexible, and we'll allow in them the kind of sensitivities that we think no reasonable person should exhibit. The balance is to acknowledge the core sensitivities that everyone in this particular society has a right to feel protected against, and also some acknowledgement of the particular individual sensitivities that people have good reason within this culture to experience.
Of course, it occurs to me too, if you're going to put the emphasis on cultural differences, that's going to create more problems for a very heterogeneous culture than one that's very homogeneous. If, for example, in a place like the United States, where you have so many different subcultures as well, then what might be offensive, what might be information that one culture, some members of the culture, society might want to be kept private, would be very different.
That's why I think there's a nice catch-all phrase that individuals have good reason to feel sensitive about the disclosure of some matter, and then we can do the work on what will count as a good reason.
Yeah, I was going to say that could be a problem, though, because if there really are substantial cultural differences, then part of the problem will be is individuals from one culture just won't understand that members of another culture might have different kinds of expectations.
That problem generalizes across all legal and political issues from the existence of cultural plurality. It's not specific to the problem of privacy.
Okay. Well, let's pause just for the benefit of anyone who may be tuning in late. This is Ideas and Issues. My guest today is David Archer from the Department of Moral Philosophy at the University of St. Andrews, Scotland, and we're discussing privacy. Let's shift to the sort of principal aim of your paper. We've been talking in a general way about privacy. The general aim of your paper is to address questions about the privacy of public figures. you acknowledge that public figures are often are and perhaps often can be treated a bit differently than a private figure. That someone, for example, who is a politician, might be treated a bit differently than you or I would by the press. And you suggest that there are three different arguments that people tend to give for why you might treat public figures differently than private figures. Could you first of all briefly mention what those three arguments are, and then we'll go back and look at each of them in some depth?
Yes, certainly. It seems to me that the three can be summarily described as follows. There is a sort of view that is expressed as, in virtue of becoming a public figure, you lose any rights to privacy. There's something about your change into a public figure that results in the loss of privacy. That's kind of one argument. The second is that there is a public interest in knowing certain facts about you as a public figure, and to that extent you lose a right to privacy. And the third argument that I wanted to look at was the view that, well, the public, that is us, the rest of society, just happen to be interested in what it is you're doing as a public figure, and that's a reason why you shouldn't have any privacy.
Okay. Well, let's look at the first one. The first one is one that certainly gets tossed around in the media, the idea that somehow once you become a public figure, you lose any right to privacy. I take it you don't think that's a very good argument.
Well, I can't see any way in which you can show good reasons to think that's how we should think about public figures. I mean, there's no evidence that somebody in entering into public life agrees or contracts with the rest of society along the lines of saying, I acknowledge that in becoming a public figure, you have every right to know whatever you want to about me. Public figures will say that, of course, the price of fame and the price of public status is that people do become exceptionally interested in your private life and will make strenuous efforts to find out what you're doing. But the fact is, they will also say that there's no obvious right that the public acquires in virtue of your becoming a public figure. It might be that you think that somehow it's only fair or just or equitable that if you gain from being a public figure, you should lose in other respects. And one of the respects in which you lose is by losing your privacy. Again, I can't see how that justifies the loss of privacy, because it might just simply be said, well, look, there are gains that you deserve in virtue of being a public figure. There's no reason in natural justice why you should simply lose out to a corresponding degree. And, of course, there's no reason to think that you should lose in a specific respect of losing your privacy.
Okay. What about the second argument, the argument that people have some sort of public interest in knowing about your private life?
Well, the notion...
First of all, give an example.
Sure. Yeah. Well, I think that the kind of cases that are uncontroversial are where an individual who is occupying a duty, a public office that to which attaches considerable responsibilities, and we know of this particular figure that in their private life they're engaged in a form of conduct which, and it might not even be immoral in itself, but nevertheless seriously damages their good performance of that public role. Now, I think here we have a public interest right, grounded right, to know what it is they're doing in private. And if the obvious cases would be a minister who, in fact, is a government official who is in charge of the arrangements whereby particular work is allocated to companies for state work, and we learn that he's actually a director of one of the companies who might benefit from one of these tenders. Now, clearly, he has no right to keep that private, because that is the sort of material fact that affects his ability to discharge his public duty impartially and in our interests. Corruption, commission of criminal acts in private, acts of private treachery, all of these can be considered acts that we should, we as a public have a right to know about.
Okay. Now, clearly there can be some disagreements. Let me just come up with one that's happened here. And I mention it because it's an example of something of a private action that's not immoral. There have been at least two public figures that I can think of whose children are being sent to non-state-supported schools, are being sent to what are called private schools in the United States. That information has come out in the press. Now, would that be an example of an invasion of the person's privacy, telling the public where the son of a potential prime minister might be going to school, or the daughter of the Secretary of Education?
Let's accept for the moment that this is the kind of information that is on the public record, at least in the way in which education is organized in this country. It's the sort of documented evidence that it might be difficult to construct as personal and private in the required sense. But let's say, okay, this is the sort of thing that a person concerned wants to keep private and thinks he has every right to keep private. What would show a justification for its disclosure? In the kind of cases I think you're alluding to, the obvious reason is demonstration of hypocrisy. That is a conflict between private behavior and public declarations of the appropriate behavior. If we could show that an individual as a politician deems X or Y to be the appropriate way for people to behave, and yet we learn that in their own private life they behaved in ways utterly inconsistent, indeed contradicting that prescription, then I think we have a right to know. We have a right to know, I think, if we're pushed. Why do we have a right to know? Well, because we might begin to believe that their public declaration of support for these policies is insincere. They don't really believe it when they say these things. Actually, if we look at what they do privately, it shows that their real beliefs lie elsewhere. Or simply we have an interest in hypocrisy full stop, because we think it's a relevant defect in a politician that they're hypocritical. And we might, if we knew that fact about them, not have voted for them, or not be prepared to support them in continued office. Those seem to me the sort of ways we'd reason about that kind of case.
Okay, but now that gets to the problem you're saying. If there's a demonstration of hypocrisy, then arguably that's information about the person that could be made public, even though it might ordinarily be private. Now, who's going to decide whether you have a demonstration of hypocrisy?
Oh, well, look, I mean, we all know that with the best regulations, people can resort to rationalizations. And let's say we're talking about the regulations that govern the behavior of the press. It will always be possible for an enterprising and intelligent and ingenious press editor to find some explanation of why they've disclosed a private act that conforms to, let's say, our requirement that only the demonstration of hypocrisy is sufficient. And if we saw sufficiently repeated cases of this going on, we might begin to wonder if the regulations were being abused. But most press regulations that are short of statutory legal requirements are going to depend very heavily on the good faith of the press editors. That's the way it works in Britain at the moment, in many other countries. Let's then assume that press editors are sincere, conscientious individuals, and as far as possible, they'll seek to conform to the spirit of their regulations, and they will have to honestly believe that a good public interest is served in a particular interest by exposing the hypocrisy of some individual.
Now, I can imagine someone who's opposed to any kind of regulations at all, though, might come back in the following way. The problem is that's still allowing someone other than the public to make a determination about what's relevant information about a public figure. It puts in the hands of an editor, it gives an editor the power to say, I have some information about this public figure, and I'm going to choose not to release it to the public because I don't see that it's demonstrably relevant to their suitability for public office. Mm. For example, true both the United States and true here, one of the things which for years has been brought up about political candidates has been their sexual behavior, going back to the very first case. In the case of Gary Hart, for example, in the United States, it was the demise of his presidential candidacy. Now, on your view, his private sexual behavior was irrelevant. And I can imagine some editors saying his private sexual behavior is irrelevant to his suitability to be president. But someone might say, well, wait a moment. Let's let the public decide if it's relevant or not. Let the press reveal anything they want about public figures. And then it's up to the individuals who read the paper, see the newscast, hear the radio program to decide what they think is relevant or irrelevant about the person's suitability for public office.
Oh, I can see the line of reasoning, but remember that the presumption is in favor of the individual's privacy. That is, it has to be the case that a reason is shown for breaching privacy rather than, as it were, there being no presumption in favor of the individual's privacy. Now, of course, it might be the case that an editor can just say, well, here's my case. Here's why I want to do it. I just think I can show Gary Hart to be a hypocrite, and I'll do so by disclosing private information. Given the presumption in favor of Gary Hart's privacy, he presumably will have within any set of regulations the basis to appeal, to lodge a complaint and to seek compensation or damages. And that tribunal will have to be a suitably constructed, impartial one that will weigh up the claim that can be made both by the press editor in this case and the individual. Now, if the punishments are suitably severe, I think it's unlikely that press editors are going to run with a view that, well, I'll find a reason retrospectively for why I did that that conforms to the spirit of the regulations. Indeed, the major complaint in Britain has simply been that the regulations are weakened by the incapacity of the authorities to administer them in a suitably effective way. The press just don't fear the regulations.
Okay. Now, having said all that, you reject those two arguments. You think there's at least one argument that has some plausibility. Could you run that one back?
Yeah, it's an argument that I think needs to be run for its own sake and see how far it takes us. And that is simply the fact that the public are interested in knowing certain facts about public figures. Most people who mention this claim do so in order either to reject it or certainly to ridicule it, or it's simply to distinguish it from the public interest. That is, they say there's a difference between a public interest being served by and the public being interested in. But it seems to me it is a fact about us that we are interested in what others in our society do, and that the disclosure by the press of the private behavior of public figures functions very much in the way that gossip within a small community does. That is, it's the exchange of information about the behavior of those we count as our co-members or co-citizens. Now, we might think the motives that lead us to engage in this gossip are rather unpleasant or distasteful ones, and far rather that people didn't do it. But let's say it is a fact about us that we engage in this kind of gossip. All of us do. Does it have any useful functions? Well, one is that gossip, wherever it occurs, serves as a forum within which we can explore those ideals that we take ourselves as a community to share. And one of the things that we're doing when we gossip about politicians' sexual proclivities is trying to test out how seriously we take codes of sexual behavior. And we do it about public figures because we think public figures should, above all other members of our community, in some sense exemplify those virtues or be the first to adhere to them. So it does seem to me that the notion of large-scale, electronic or media-based gossip about public figures isn't, as it appears at first hand, so obviously wrong or terrible.
Okay. Well, I see we've come to a close. Thank you very much for appearing on the show.
Thank you very much.
Good talking today with David Archer from the Department.